Eccoci, la Biennale Tecnologia ospita David Weinberg, è un filosofo straordinariamente acuto, inclusivo, gentile e come vedrete capace di mettere in chiaro quello che per noi è talmente grande, talmente complicato, talmente imprendibile. Da aiutarci a viverci in mezzo. Certo, quest'anno è stato un anno nel quale il caos, la complessità ha preso possesso della nostra vita quotidiana e un libro come quello che David ha appena pubblicato sul caos quotidiano arriva molto gradito. Non perché ci aiuti a dare a ridurre il caos, ma ci aiuta a conviverci, che poi è che stiamo facendo con un sacco di altri problemi. David Weinberger è strasuper noto per aver partecipato alla scrittura del Cluj Manifesto, ma dopo quel libro famosissimo che ha anticipato l'idea di conversazione nella rete, di visione sociale della rete internet, ha proseguito convergendo nella sua ricerca con quello che è sempre stato un filosofo ironico, distaccato dalle sue stesse idee, ma coerente nella ricerca che lo ha portato sempre più vicino all'indagine sulla conoscenza stessa. E negli ultimi due libri la conoscenza è particolarmente protagonista di quello che ci racconta, troppo grande per essere conosciuto e poi adesso il caos quotidiano. Nel caos quotidiano il protagonista è l'intelligenza artificiale o gli umani che si confrontano con l'intelligenza artificiale o gli umani che cercano di confrontarsi con se stessi. Lo vedremo nella lezione di stasera. David, oltre a essere un filosofo notevolissimo, una persona gentilissima, è una firma di grande importanza per molti giornali, tra i quali vale la pena di ricordarlo, ha collaborato anche al Woody Allen, che era un giornale che ovviamente, come dice il nome, faceva dell'ironia la sua base e il suo motivo di essere. E questo lo dico non tanto perché è un aneddoto, quanto per il fatto che il tipo di approccio di David Weinberger alla filosofia non è quello di colui che spiega la verità, ma quello di chi la cerca. E l'ironia non è un espediente per far ridere, è una vera e propria consustanziale caratteristica del suo atteggiamento nei confronti, prima di tutto, di se stesso. Io penso che conoscerlo sia un grande privilegio e avere la possibilità di sentire la sua lezione oggi è un grande onore. E poi, naturalmente, come vedete dalla vostra interfaccia, c'è la possibilità di fare domande a David Weinberger. Eccolo per voi.
Thank you so much for having me. It's an honor to be here. Luca is an old friend at this point, and I really appreciate that very warm introduction, which only overstates things some. So yes, we're going to talk about AI, in particular machine learning, but I also want to put this in a context, which includes particularly of the internet. And we're going to also talk about chaos, but I mean that in a particular way, because Lord knows we've been living with enough very, very bad destructive chaos, and seems to be getting worse and worse. And that's not exactly the sort of chaos that I have in mind. premise of my talk is that we interpret ourselves, we understand ourselves in terms of our dominant technology, which I think most of us will agree are, at this point, the internet and AI. We are in the age of the internet, we're moving into the age of AI. What I'm going to be saying is that the net has conditioned us to living in chaos of a particular type. We've gotten very used to it over the past 20 years. AI is giving us a way of understanding that chaos, of sort of making sense of it, a model for it. So I'm going to start with the internet and then we'll move to AI. So let's talk about the internet from this particular perspective. So if it's 1908 and you are Henry Ford, the US car manufacturer, and you want to come up with your new car, the Model T, you take a handful of engineers and you work with them for almost a year in a very small room, and you figure out what your market is going to want, and then you build exactly that. And if you are a genius of the sort that Henry Ford was, he was a terrible person, but he was a genius at what he did, then you design it so well in 1908 that 19 years later, you're still selling the same car. You've sold 15 million of them, and you have made basically zero changes because you anticipated so well what your market is going to need. And so Henry Ford becomes this avatar of design and anticipating what a market's going to want. And that's how we have worked for a long time. But if it's 2008 and you're Dropbox, an online company, of course, and you are launching a product, you don't do at all what Henry Ford did. You do the opposite. You figure out what are the minimal features that your users are going to want, and you start selling it to them with that minimal feature set on the grounds that over time you can see what they use, what they don't use, what they want, and the like. And you can figure out, based on that information, what it is that you should be building for them. So this is the equivalent of a minimum viable product, a very common way of launching products on the internet. Minimal feature set, hold back from anticipating, and then add features as you learn what people want. Well, we're going to talk about more things like this, but I want to point out right at the beginning that this basic way of approach, the minimum viable product Dropbox way of approaching, is so thoroughly different from Henry Ford's. And in fact, not just Henry Ford's, but Henry Ford's basic strategy is the one that we as a species have been using literally since Paleolithic times, since before we were cave people. And that strategy of strategies has been to anticipate what's going to happen and then to prepare for it. And clearly this works very, very well because we are the dominant species on the planet, but there's a hidden price to it that we've been paying for tens of thousands of years. We anticipate what's going to happen and then we prepare for it. We anticipate there are going to be woolly mammoths that we can hunt, and so we prepare for it by building spears. Could not be more basic, but that's not what Dropbox and other companies like it do. And this is not simply companies that engage in the minimum viable product approach, although that is, as I say, very common on the internet. It permeates the internet. It's in many ways, it is what is distinctive about life and business on the internet. For example, the iPhone, there was not many features of the iPhone that had not been in other phones before it. What was really new and revolutionary about it was not a feature, it was that it had an app store. And that app store meant that Apple did not have to anticipate all the uses that people would want to put the phone to. Rather, anybody who could program, could put together a feature, a product, a service, put it into the app store, hope they get it approved, and then this is now something new, unanticipated, that your iPhone can do. And that's what drove the iPhone to its incredible success. And there are obviously millions of apps now. And it's not just app stores and telephones, it's also the gaming industry, which everybody knows, I hope, is huge, is bigger than the movie industry. Minecraft, which has sold a mind-boggling number of copies, one of the reasons is that the game allows users to make modifications, to add features, to change the way the game works, to change what the game is. There are well over 50,000 mods, as they're called. And this is not new with Minecraft. This has been going on literally since the beginning of electronic gaming. This is extremely common. And it's not just in these businesses and products that we see this sort of holding back from anticipating so that others can move the products in the way that they want them to, add on to them, extend them, to integrate them. This is also integral to all of the open movements, the movement for open access to content, to open source for programs, to open APIs, to online services. All of these allow resources to be used in ways that the creators did not anticipate. In fact, I think it's fair to say that we have been moving online from the strategy of anticipating to the strategy of unanticipating. And we do this because it lowers our risk, because not everybody's Henry Ford. Most people get it wrong when they launch a product to some degree. So this lowers the risk that you'll get it wrong. And it allows other people to add value to your products the way that the mods add value to Minecraft and all of the extensions that Slack, for example, or Dropbox allows to be made by other people, adds value to them. So I think in a way it's reasonable to say it's as if we've spent the past 20 years making the world more unpredictable and doing it on purpose. And this is a measure of the success of the internet. It's one of the most important reasons why the internet has succeeded. And I think this changes our mind about some things. We get used to this. The fact that you know everything I just told you, I didn't tell you anything new, but the fact that we've so come to accept this strategy of unanticipation after tens of thousands of years of assuming anticipate and prepare, that by itself is remarkable. But I think it also has an effect on how we think, well, about many things, but including about how we think about the future. Because we had been thinking about the future, at least one of the ways of we think about it, is that the future consists of possibilities that are off in the distance. And the further off in the distance they are, the more possibilities there are. But as the future approaches, those possibilities narrow. So your job is to anticipate, to figure out, this is the traditional view, right? That is to figure out what possibility is going to survive and become real, or to bend the possibility so that it's the one that you want. So you see the possibilities out ahead of you, you choose which one is best for you or best for the world, if you're actually a good person, and then you do everything you can to try to get that to be the possibility that works. And if it does, great. You win. That idea of the future as being something that narrows and narrows and narrows is very restrictive. It's also pretty deeply held within us. But as we go, as we keep experiencing on the internet, we keep making more possibilities or using possibilities that others have enabled for us. We build this into our business, into our products. And as a result, one could say that the imperative has become to make more future. Not to narrow the future to the one that you want, but just to make more possibilities and more future. So I want to try to put this in quickly into another light, which is this, you know, step back and say, well, you know, what are some characteristics of the internet? Clearly, it's a complex dynamic system. It's very complicated. It's always changing. Feedback loops of all sorts. I mean, it's incredibly intertwined, as Ted Nelson would say. So it's a complex dynamic system. It's very sensitive to initial conditions. That is, where it starts has just a lot to do with where it ends up. And you can see this every day. If you look at your browsing history any day and you see where you started and where you end up, most of us can't remember how we got from where we started to where we ended up at the end of the day. That initial condition, what happened to be on our screen, determines just a lot of where we go, what we spend our time doing on the internet that day. Third, on the internet, very small events become very big events. They can cause great big changes. And the most obvious example of this is when things go viral. Because usually you cannot predict that it will go viral. And you can't figure out why this video or this GIF went viral and that one didn't. This is the butterfly effect, right? A small event making big changes. And finally, the result of all this is the internet is so unpredictable. Now, I go through these because these four characteristics are also characteristics of the mathematical theory known as chaos theory that arose, became visible in the 1970s, and was sort of in the popular media generally looked at as just, you know, isn't it funny what these crazy mathematicians are saying? It's so amusing. But we're now living. We are living in the world that chaos theory describes. We're living on the internet. We're living in it, and we like it. Now, I understand that the internet has so many problems. And I'm not talking about them because I think we all understand how many problems, how awful the internet is for so many people. And it's often awful in different ways for those of us who don't, who basically like it. But we go on it on our own, even when we don't have to, because there's something there, there's something about it that we like. And I'm going to suggest much of that is, in fact, its chaotic nature. The fact that it's so unpredictable, that things are so connected in so many ways, you can follow links forever. We like the chaos of the internet. We've been living in it for 20 years. The world begins to look more like the way our dominant technology, in this case, the internet, shows itself to us. So that's what I wanted to say about the internet. The second part has to do with machine learning, AI, but these days when people talk about AI, they generally mean machine learning. And although I'm sure I'm going to give you the world's fastest overview of what it is, just to make sure we're talking about the same thing. Okay. So traditional programming works by a developer, a programmer, figures out or is told that these are the factors that influence the outcome that we're interested in. So if it's a business, it's all these sorts of things that you see, sorts of things that would go on a spreadsheet. And a spreadsheet is a type of program. And then the developer connects them. What are their relationships? And on a spreadsheet, it's the formulas and equations, right? But it's the same in virtually all programming. It's the factors and their logic or their relationships. Not with machine learning. Machine learning takes data from each of these fields, but it drops the information about how they're connected. When you train a machine learning model, that is when you build a machine learning system, you don't tell it what we know about the relationship among all the types of data that you're giving it, which seems crazy, but it turns out that many things about machine learning seem crazy, but it works. The system goes through and it looks at all this data and looks for correlations. And the correlations may be strong, they may be weak, they may be false correlations, but it figures all of those together and it creates a network of weighted nodes of weighted relationships among all of these different types of information, having no idea what the data stands for. It's just numbers. But when the system is trained, it then can produce results that are more accurate than what we would get without using machine learning. And if it doesn't, then we don't use machine learning. We use it because it's more accurate. And so these relationships that consist of all of these weighted relationships can be so vast and complex that in some cases, at least, we cannot understand what they are. Machine learning systems in general, all of this is changing, of course, but in general, they're not built with an eye to making them understandable. And so sort of their natural state is to be a black box. Doesn't mean you can't open up the black box to some degree, but they're not designed to be systems that we can understand. They start out as basically as black boxes, and yet they are giving us more accurate results than the old way of programming. What this means is that there's an extremely strong chance in the next few years you're going to go visit your doctor for your checkup, and the doctor's going to say, everything looks good, but there's a 72% chance you'll develop type 2 diabetes in 5 years. And you'll say, oh, that can't be right. I eat right. I don't eat a lot of sugar. I'm skinny. I exercise. There's no diabetes in my family. That's why. That doesn't seem likely. And your doctor's going to say something like, well, we don't know. This is a machine learning system that we have. We put in tons and tons of data. We've put in medical records for 700,000 people in one case, 500 data points each. And in our experience so far with it, when it says there's a 72% chance, it's right. It's 72% of the time it's right, you know. And so what it may not be right, that's perfectly, it's a probability, but what do you want to do about it? You can ignore it. I mean, let's have that conversation. That's disturbing. I understand that's disturbing. It's disturbing for a couple of reasons. And the most one, and the most talked about one, is that these systems, so the original sin of machine learning is bias, because machine learning is learning from data that reflects our culture and society and economy. And we know that our culture, society, and economy are biased. It contains biases, and machine learning can pick up on those. It can amplify those. And this is a huge problem, which I am not going to talk about, only because it's talked about so much. So I'm going to hope you either already know about this, or you will read more about it later, because it is a crucial problem for machine learning. Very, very real. The result has been what I think is a moral panic, a panic about the ethical outcomes of machine learning. And it's good to see this, because we need to address the bias problems, but there's something else going on as well. So you get to this sort of moral panic by reading, hearing, seeing people exclaiming, "We don't know how it works, but we don't know how it works," which in many instances is true. And that gives rise to a sense of, well, how are we going to manage it and make sure that it's giving us fair ethical results? Excellent question. But there's another part of this. There's a panic that comes not from, "We don't know how it works," that comes from the fact that it works. These black boxes that contain deeply complex relationships among what can be tens of thousands or more factors. And we just don't have the mental capacity. Our brains simply cannot follow each one all the way through to see exactly why it says you're going to get diabetes, 72% chance. That is really deeply disturbing, and I think is causing a metaphysical panic, not just an ethical one. And what I mean by that is, I think we're at a point of thinking disruption. Oop, I went too far, one too many clicks. let's redo that slide. Okay, so it's automatic. That doesn't matter. Pretend you're seeing a cosmic Earth against the background. We have, for thousands of years in the West, we have assumed that to be human is to be the creature that can understand how the world works, at least to some degree. We are the rational animals, which means it only matters to be a rational animal if you think that the universe, the world, is somehow rational. It doesn't do any good to be rational animals if the world is not. And so we've invested very heavily in our idea of ourselves as the creatures that can make sense of this. And it turns out now we are benefiting from a technology. Every time you pick up your mobile phone, you are almost, you're one click away from an app that is powered by machine learning, whether it's type ahead, autocorrect and autofill, or it's weather, et cetera. We are benefiting from a technology that doesn't care that what it's doing may not be explicable to us. And it works because the world underneath it is inexplicable. It's capturing more truth about the world. So I want to talk about two things that may be changing here as we come to inhabit this notion that the world is so far beyond our ability to understand it. Explanations and fairness. So let's start with explanations. So you are on a back road, going somewhere, you're here, you took the back road because you were late and this is a shortcut, and you get a flat tire. And you want to know the flat tire, so you look around and there's a nail. And so you say quite properly, there's my explanation, I ran over a nail. And this type of explanation is a very important type, sine qua non, there but for the nail. If the nail hadn't been there, it wouldn't have gotten the flat tire. Perfectly true, incredibly useful, certainly not going to argue against that, but I do want to make the following point. Because they're not the only sine qua non in this scenario. It also had to be the case, well, if you hadn't been late, you wouldn't have taken this back road. No back road, no nail, no flat. If you hadn't swerved for a rabbit that caused you then to run over the nail, you wouldn't have gotten it. So it's the rabbit is a sine qua non. They're softer than Rubber? No flat tire. If pointy things didn't penetrate better, no flat tire. If humans didn't care about getting places fast, and if car companies made more money by selling you steel wheels, no flat tire. If gravity were not in effect, you would not have gotten the flat tire. And if the spaceships who hover over our planet failed to harvest our surface iron because they are a rust-based metabolism, you would not have gotten that tire. Everything had to happen for you to get that flat tire. Everything is a sine qua non. So why, quite reasonably and properly, pick out the nail as the explanation? And the answer is really simple. It's that the nail is the one thing we can change. We can't go back in time and not take the road. We can't suspend gravity. The one thing we can change is the nail out of the tire. That's why the nail is an explanation. It's not, explanations are not a property of the world. They are a tool that we use in particular situations. They are little beams, they're flashlights, they're lanterns that we take into the forest and that illuminate the world for us, at least a little bit. The fact is that they are not part of the world. The world doesn't even owe us an explanation. And if it gave us one, we wouldn't understand it. And it may be that the complexity and interrelatedness of the pieces that go into a machine learning model are teaching us this, and are also the fact that we can use these systems usually quite successfully without knowing how they work may also be teaching us that explanations are not a fact of the world, not a property of the world. They are a tool we use in the world. The second chunk I want to talk about fairness. And it is often pointed out, and really helpfully important that this is pointed out, that AI has very much to learn from fairness and about fairness. Because machine learning doesn't have any idea what's fair. It just knows it's been given some data and you've asked for some type of output. And it doesn't care if the answer is horribly biased. I mean, it's just a computer. It doesn't care, literally, does not care about anything. So it's really important that AI be taught more about fairness. That is, that machine learning developers in the process of creating these systems work with everybody who is going to be affected by the AI to make sure that their values are being represented and everything is fair. So that's hugely important. A lot of work is going into it, which makes me very happy. But again, just as with bias, I'm not going to talk about that because I think it's more well-known. Instead, I want to make a different claim, which is, yeah, AI has much to learn from fairness, but fairness also has much to learn from AI. AI, machine learning, is teaching us some very important lessons about fairness. They're difficult and painful lessons, but I think really important. So no doubt that AI brings up risks to fairness, but it also gives us an opportunity. So you can ask, why is it, fairness is the common term used these days when talking about these moral issues of AI. But fairness has a very it's not a prominent term in Western philosophy. Justice is, morality is. fairness is not. And why? It's because in the philosophical tradition in the West, fairness has been sort of like folk medicine, if you know what I mean, the way a doctor would consider folk medicine. It just has not been taken very seriously. And that's because fairness is extremely simple. And I think that's why that simplicity is bringing it forward now. It's a very useful term. But it's useful because it really cuts things down to their simplest. So I'm going to give you a simple example. I think maybe the most common example when people are asked to explain what they mean by fairness. It's the cookie example. Just in time. Sorry, I can hear somebody children, which sounds completely delightful. So let's say you have two children and you're giving them cookies. And you look at this, one of them got cookies, one got seven. That's unfair. That's, you know, on the face of it, that's unfair. But then if I were to do that, the child on the left has diabetes, and thus, you know, two cookies is probably too much already. Or if I were to tell you that the child on the right had a little contract with his parents, which said if he did his chores, he had more cookies, because the family likes, it's a good capitalist family, and you know, you want to give your, and so in that case, it suddenly becomes at least more fair. And the reason why it becomes more fair is that fairness generally means that people get the same treatment unless there's a relevant difference. Having doing extra work, those are relevant differences. And so it's not unfair in those cases. If I were to say that, oh no, the reason why the child on the left got fewer cookies is because of her skin color, that would be a wildly irrelevant difference and would be clearly unfair. So very, very simple concept. And it's obviously a very powerful and important one. So my job now is to make it more complex, because I think that's what machine learning is doing. So I want to give you an example of a type of an application of machine learning that I think is very problematic, but is being used, which is to sort through job applicants, to pick out the set of people who should be brought in for an in-person interview. And so you get you're the manager of the system, these applications, and it spits out a handful. Fine. You are the outcome. And so you look at the applicant pool and you discover that, it's 50% men and women, which is fantastic. You manage to, get a balanced applicant pool. Look at who, the gender of who made it into the interview pool. And you see, 85% men and only 15% women. And so you're going to say, that really doesn't sound, there's wrong here. So the very first thing you're going to do as the manager, very likely, is to check your data. Is this bias from the data? Very likely, if you haven't done it at the data, it will very likely learn that bias. But you were confident that the data had been cleaned of that sort of bias. And you go back and you check again. And yeah, it looks like there are no references to gender or to anything that correlates with gender and the like. And you say, well, it's not the data. The data looks good. It's just, this is what it's giving us. And so somebody in your company, when you report this, will say, well, then, if it's not considering gender, then whatever the outcome is, it's gender blind fairness. And if it happens to work out, it's 15% women, that's what it means to be gender blind. I'm going to give you three of these theories. I'm not arguing for any of them, but there's some plausibility to that, right? I mean, it's gender blind. But somebody else is going to look at it and say, yeah, maybe it's gender blind in that sense. But there's still something wrong with it, because there's a history of discrimination against women in employment. And maybe that's being, somehow being resurfaced, even not in the data, but, how many women have a lot of work experience. And so we should do some rebalancing, somebody is going to say, and you're going to say, because you're the manager of the system, you're going to say, well, here's the way that it works. As you probably know, the system looks at the factors, looks at the data, and what threshold is high enough for somebody to make it into the interview pile. And it's 80%, and it's the same for men or women. And so you're going to say, now we could change that, right? We could make the threshold higher for men and lower for women. I can tell you right now, just by running those numbers, that will bring in a different mix. That will result in a much, 56% men. I'm making all this up, of course. 56 will be 44% women, which is much closer to what we think is fair. And some people are going to say, absolutely, we need to do that. And others are going to say, wait a minute. That means you are applying a higher standard to the men simply because they are lower to the because they are women. Those are, I thought we decided, irrelevant differences. And so this isn't fair. You're penalizing the men. Again, I have my opinions. I'm not going to express them. It is at least a plausible idea, model of fairness. Anyway, which is every machine learning system will generate some false negatives. In this case, those are people who should have been in the interview pile, but for one reason or another weren't. And somebody's going to say, why don't you go back and check those? And you do. And it turns out that only 5% of men who should have been interviewed were not, but 33% of women were. And so that's a vast inequity in who has an opportunity. So everything gets confusing. These were the simplest models of fairness I could find for machine learning, but there's at least 6 well-known ones. There's over 20 that are discussed. And each of them, they get harder and harder to make sense of because more and more mathematical and statistical, but they each have some plausibility. And the point is, we have to decide. We who are going to manage machine learning system have to decide what's fair. We can't just say to the machine learning system, be fair. We have to tell it exactly what we mean by being fair. Now, one of the good things about this, there are a number of good things. One of them is that tools are being developed. This is the What If tool. It was made by Google Pair, who I should say I was a writer in residence for 2 years, but I have no connection to. And it's a free open source tool. Anyway, this is one of the tools that gives you, lets you examine your machine learning system, examine your model to look for things that are unfair or that need adjustment or why things are happening. And one of the little tabs on it is one that includes a set of 5 fairness buttons, 5 different models of fairness, like the 3 that I gave you. You can click it and see what happens, what the results are for your data with each of those models of fairness. So in other words, you can now play what if with fairness. Now, you remember when personal computers became important, it was because they, largely because people could use them for spreadsheets, which allows you to play what if with your business. Suppose we hired another 10 salespeople. Suppose we cut the number of outlets or sales outlets or whatever. And that was liberating. That was an amazing tool. Now we are developing tools that allow us to play what if with fairness. We never have had these before. The problem is getting harder, but our ability to deal with it is also getting more sophisticated. And so saying that, fairness, we like fairness because it's simple. Well, sure. But it turns out that it masks a tremendous complexity, and machine learning is forcing us to be specific about that complexity. I think that's a really, really good thing. Why? Because it's the truth. Fairness never was simple. The application of it is incredibly difficult and always has been. That's why we don't agree about things, even as basic as fairness. Now we are being forced to define what we mean by fairness and to have human discussions about it. This is happening because it's not just fairness that's complex. It's the world that's complex. It's the world that is the black box. It is the ultimate black box. We are being forced to recognize that and to deal with it. And this is happening because we now have a technology in machine learning that gives us benefit from acknowledging that complexity by feeding in so much data that we can't figure out exactly how it's putting together outputs that are more accurate and helpful than we could on our own. It is the world that is this black box. And this is, in this sense, I'm going to say chaos is the truth. This is how the world is. And now that we have a technology that enables us to benefit from acknowledging that fact, I think we are beginning to embrace it. And I think that is tremendously exciting. I think it is a evolutionary step for us, a Copernican size step for human beings to recognize that. Thanks.
My son was here, as you heard. So I'm happy you were smiling at that. One thing that form doesn't allow to have is applause, and I would like you to get one of those at the end of your speech. Embracing the chaos, embracing the truth is chaos. It's a strange time for saying things like this while we are talking all the time about fake. And fake is also managed by AI. So in my comment, I would like to have an autobiographical instance, which is the fact that in my name, my very name, there is the bias. And the bias is my mission to de-bias things. That's why I'm not going to talk about that. You just passed through that problem of bias while you talked about women at job and job searching and everything, which is also a problem of biases in of probable biases in data and algorithms and everything. So the truth is in chaos, and chaos contains also the fake. This is chaotic. This is truly chaotic. We're waiting for questions from our public, but one has arrived. Io ricordo al pubblico che è possibile mandare adesso le domande, è il momento di farlo. Il caos quotidiano, il caos come verità, il caos che contiene se stesso e il suo contrario, ma anche che cosa vuol dire l'intelligenza artificiale, che cosa vuol dire quello che sta succedendo a internet, che è diventata la rete che ospita il cambiamento verso l'intelligenza artificiale. The first question that has come, David, is from some young people in Italy that created the New Train Manifesto. Have you heard about that?
No, I have not.
Well, that's why they posed the question. They asked the question because this way you will hear about them.
Good.
They
I'm
are,
glad to hear about it.
Yeah. They are in advertising. They work in a school of storytelling and advertising and many other things. And it's called the Scuola Holden. It's in Turin. And one course was about advertising, and they created this New Train Manifesto. I'm not going to the details, but I made my job making them known and advertising them as they asked me to do this way. So what's your take in terms of the contextualization of this Biennale, of the major insight that there is in the New Train Manifesto. The New Train Manifesto says we have waited 20 years after the Clue Train Manifesto, and in these years many things happen. One of them is climate. Climate became the most important thing. And climate, in my knowledge, is the most chaotic thing that we know. So what's your comment about climate? Is it really the example of chaos, or is it something that we understand too well to be a real chaotic place?
Oh, no. Weather and then car, I think, excellent examples of chaos in the, I'm going to say, mathematical sense. I'm not a mathematician, so that's why I'm careful about this. In the mathematical sense in which I've tried to characterize the internet and life, for that matter. I want to be careful to distinguish that from, in the use of the word chaos, as people who are rioting in the streets because they've been oppressed and they don't know where their next meal is coming from, and there's a complete breakdown of social order. That is not what it's not what I'm talking about. Chaos. I'm pointing. It is the type of chaos that too many people live in, and that's getting worse. But chaos in this of a description of a system in which is so complex and so interrelated, so many little pieces that are in so many different relationships, dependent relationships, that it becomes impossible to predict with certainty you can do it statistically, but it's really, you know, to see the causal change, it's the opposite of the pool ball that, you know, the ball that hits another billiard ball. It's of that view of the universe. So climate, I'll start with weather, and then is follows straight from that. But we've gotten much better at predicting weather because of machine learning. It was only around 1900 that we started predicting weather based upon looking at the forces in the world that are affecting the atmosphere. And this was an application of Newton's laws to the atmosphere. So somebody finally figured out how to do that meaningfully to wind and moisture and that Newtonian way of applying laws works better than what came before it, and we can use fairly somewhat accurate weather predictions. And with the advent of machine learning, we now have far more accurate, far further into the distance, and get hourly, pretty reliable hourly predictions. The problem is that with the old way of doing it is that there are so many factors that affect weather. Basically, everything on the surface of the planet, and therefore the surface and on top of the surface, affects weather. And most of it doesn't make much effect, but some of it is a butterfly effect thing. A little change, and suddenly you've got a spike in temperature that changes a wind pattern. Weather is chaotic in this sense. We cannot understand every factor, but we've now been for decades been collecting so much data, so much satellite data. We have machine learning systems that can process that data, not looking for fundamental laws, but looking just for combinations of circumstances, that we've gotten much better at predicting weather. It's the same thing for climate, except more, in some ways, more complex, because you're looking out not 10 days, but centuries. The factors that affect climate are basically everything on the surface of the Earth and all that which causes things on the surface of the Earth. We currently, as I understand it, there are a number of very powerful models. We don't know which one is the single best, so instead there are mathematical operations performed on the outcomes of all of them, which together provide a more accurate prediction of where our climate is going and how we might be able to change it. Is that too much of an answer or not an answer?
It was an answer. It was an answer with many parts. There are three more questions from the audience and 8 minutes for our time. Francesco has kept a little bit of something that we already mentioned before, but it's an interesting way to put the question. He says, data and information could lie in several ways. What instruments exist in order to manage this matter?
So it depends. Yes, I mean, they can lie, they can be mistaken, and your choice of which data to collect already helps determine what your outputs are going to be. There are technical sides of this, which I cannot address. It is a wonderful question, Francesco, by the way. I won't even pretend to try to address, but there's a lot of work being done. There's work being done on trying to verify data, but there's also a lot of socio-technical work being done trying to help developers of machine learning systems get better at including data and voices that they otherwise might not. Data and voices that represent the truth and the interests of people who will be affected by the machine learning system. And that's hugely, hugely important. And it's not, I don't think it's something that ever gets completely settled. It's you always better at it, and you always do it somewhat inadequately. But we're now, I think, at the point where for the past couple of years, people have started in the industry have started taking seriously the need to not leave it to the developers to figure out, oh, this is good data, let's use that. They have an important role in this, but so does the community that's going to be affected by it.
There are quite a bit questions. Quite a few questions. So it means that your audience is following and participating. That's a sign that you should get. We will not be able to address all the questions. Luca is asking if this machine learning thing is going to be accessible to many or to few in terms of creation of it. I mean, I guess the question is this going to be polarizing, creating more people that are in the 99 and less people that are in the 1%?
So it certainly will become more accessible. That's already happening. I mean, it's normal sort of technology curve where difficult things get made easier and more people can participate. And that's already happening, right? But that doesn't give any comfort for the really important question that Luca asks, which is this going to be polarizing? And it's really expensive and hard to do. You're talking about, and I suspect there always will be it will be using the most expensive, biggest computers we have. It will be using quantum computers as soon as they're more practical. And so for many, many commercial applications and for use, it'll be the 1%. And this is really another reason why it's really important to establish norms and perhaps regulations for what is sometimes called participatory machine learning, which does what I said in response to Francesco, which is brings in the voices of the people who are affected by the systems and does not leave it fully in the hands of engineers, especially engineers working for for-profit companies.
Francesco has another question that it's a big one, and you have 4 minutes, but you have also 4 other questions. So let's see. The question is, take it, it's great. What's the meaning of cows for a machine? What's the meaning of cows for a machine?
So to the machine has no sense. So machine is of course not what the machine thinks chaos is, because the machines don't think. But in this case, it means millions, tens of millions, hundreds of millions of small data points that are being connected through multiple of that number of connections among them. Those connections are not guided by any top-down principle of physics or laws of behavior. They're just correlations, statistical correlations. And so what comes out of a machine learning system gives its results, and let's assume that they're useful and accurate. It may well do so without ever coming, it didn't start from generalizations, it didn't start from generalizations, and it may not produce any that we as humans can understand. That is a chaotic system in terms of its nonlinear relationships among pieces, which is sort of the butterfly effect and the like. Machine has no sense of chaos, of course.
Yeah, we tend to humanize the machine and think the machine as if it was a sort of human, but it's not.
It's a machine. Really does not. And it really doesn't think like us, doesn't think at all, and it doesn't put things together the way that we do at all.
Giorgio says, if we don't really understand how AI works, but it gives us answers, will we treat the answers of machines and AI as we did once treat the answers of oracles?
It's a wonderful question. There's a philosopher named Elena Esposito who does some work on this. She's very clear-headed and rational. It's not sort of mysticism. I mean, she knows machine learning way better than I do. So I think that we already accept the output of machine learning without worrying about it in many instances. The weather report. Right, we know how to take a weather report, and we know they're pretty accurate, and it works fine. And if some of the medical systems, and it'll be different for different parts of medicine, but if some of them turn out to be just really accurate and helpful, we will accept them. We'll just get used to it, just as we already accept advice from doctors, even when we don't understand it. You know, we used aspirin for 4,000 years, willow bark, without having any idea how it worked. But, you know, we got used to it, and it worked, and it was okay that we didn't understand it. For things like, I mean, you know, for fun things and creative things, then we'll be, obviously, I think, more likely to accept and the results, to examine them. For things that matter a great deal, issues of policy, we're going to have to figure out. There will be times when we will say, I'll give you a quick example. In the U.S., unfortunately, machine learning has been used in the system, the justice system, in order to recommend sentences, or the horrible bail system that the U.S. has. And in some cases, those answers have been taken, recommendations have been taken as, nope, answers, that's it, done. Didn't take a lot of work by journalists to figure out the system was really, really biased. In a judicial system, it may well be a social decision that, no, we want people to be able to see, to challenge and be told why the system recommended what it did. And it may mean that we don't want to use AI there if it doesn't help. And that's a perfectly reasonable thing to say. On the other hand, I'll say really quickly, if you apply for a job and you don't get it, and you think you are qualified, and you see who did get it, and you think, hey, I was better, why didn't I get that job? That is a black box. At least in the US, you do not have the right to ask why you didn't get the job. And if you did, the answer is not going to be, it's not going to be a good answer. It was somebody or some committee in a room who talked about it, who had a sense of, it's a black box. We already accept black boxes in our culture. If it turns out that company never hires women or never hires anybody but elderly white men, then you look at the outcome of that and you say, now, wait a minute. You haven't hired a woman in 30 years. We have to do something about that. Totally proper. But that's not because you looked at the processing and you look at the output. So we already have a variety of ways of dealing with outcomes that we cannot explain. It's more complicated now, thanks to machine learning. But I think the same sorts of approaches probably will be taken. But I don't know.
Embracing chaos, embracing truth, embracing the humble understanding of ourselves in front of our future and the outcome of our actions. Grazie a David Weinberger, che è stato così generoso con noi, ci ha raccontato così tante cose del suo libro Caos Quotidiano, appena tradotto in italiano, e credo che sarà una lettura straordinariamente fruttuosa anche per tutti le persone del pubblico che hanno continuato a mandare domande e che non possono avere il tempo di ricevere la risposta. Io vi ringrazio tutti per essere stati qua. La Biennale Tecnologia continua e domani alle 10:30 ci ritroviamo con un altro filosofo totalmente in un altro campo, l'estetica, Mauro Carbone, che ci parlerà degli schermi e di quello che significano nel cambiamento della nostra percezione. Grazie a tutti, grazie David, sei stato come sempre grande. A presto.
Thank you so much.